The mystery of who put the oil in Egan's leather case was set aside as Pitt and Giordino began checking and testing the equipment and electronic systems of the Sea Sleuth, the survey vessel's autonomous underwater vehicle, or AUV. All agreed that for reasons of safety, the autonomous vehicle should be sent down first, rather than the manned submersible, Abyss Navigator. Utilitarian and expedient, the Sea Sleuth made a Mars lander look artistic. 7 feet high by 6 feet wide by 7 feet in length, she weighed in at slightly less than 7,000 pounds. Her skin was a thick layer of titanium, and from a distance, she looked like a huge elongated egg open on the sides, standing on sled runners. A complicated robotic arm, or manipulator, extended from one side of the vehicle. It had the muscle to lift a 400-pound anchor and the sensitivity to pick up a teacup. When the vehicle was 3 miles from the target, Birch, Pitt, and several other NUMA engineers and scientists gathered in the command center compartment just aft of the pilot house. They massed around the computer-enhanced screen, watching as the seabed 20,000 feet below unreeled as if on a scroll. Giordino sat in front of a console. He would pilot the Sea Sleuth during its journey into the abyss. Next to him, Pitt sat at the keyboard, entering a series of commands into the computer on board the AUV. While Giordino controlled the vehicle's propulsion and attitude systems, Pitt operated the cameras and lighting systems. To their side, Misty Graham sat at a table studying a copy of the Emerald Dolphin's construction plans. All other eyes were locked on the array of monitors that would relay images of what Sea Sleuth recorded in the depths. Misty was a petite woman, full of fire and vinegar, a dedicated scientist and one of the best marine biologists with NUMA. She spent far more time at sea than she did in her condominium in Washington. She looked up from the chart and spoke to Birch. "If she's caved in on herself, Sea Sleuth won't have an easy time finding anything of interest." The Emerald Dolphin appeared to be broken in 3 places. Slowly, meticulously, they explored each of them, looking for clues to the fire. "Descend down to 5 feet above the silt," Pitt told Giordino. "I want to get a look at her keel." The Sea Sleuth followed Giordino's command and crawled around the bottom of the stern that sat nearly upright. Very cautiously, inching over and around debris, he stopped the vehicle and hovered it at a point where the ship's stern section was ripped open. They could see that the massive steel keel was warped and curled downward where it had been torn in half. "Only explosives could have done that," Pitt commented.
"It's beginning to look like her bottom was blasted out," said Giordino. "Her internal structure, weakened by the fire and the blast, broke apart from the increasing water pressure during her fall to the bottom."
"That would explain her abrupt sinking," added Birch. "According to the tugboat captain, she went down so fast she almost took his boat with it."
"Which leads to the conclusion that someone had a motive for setting the ship afire and then sinking her in the deepest part of the ocean so her wreckage couldn't be examined."
"So where does that leave us?" asked Misty. Pitt stared thoughtfully at the monitors. "Sea Sleuth has done its job and shown that the Emerald Dolphin did not destroy herself. Nor was it an act of God. We have to dig deeper and come up with enough proof for an investigation.
Proof that will lead to the doorstep of the murderous slime who is responsible for the loss of a beautiful ship and more than 100 lives.
"Dig deeper?" inquired Giordino, smiling as if knowing the answer.
"How?"
Pitt looked at his friend through Machiavellian eyes. "You and I go down on the wreck ourselves, in the Abyss Navigator, and bring home the goods." A 4-man submersible, the Abyss Navigator's nerve center was a round titanium alloy ball that housed the pilot and the technician who controlled the life support systems, external lights, cameras, and 2 manipulator arms. The latter were mounted under the round hull and protruded like the special effects arms of a robot in a science fiction movie. A metal basket sat under the mechanical fingers to retrieve any artifacts picked off the bottom.
Connected to the tubular framework around the manned ball were the pressure housings for the electronics, batteries, and communications equipment. The navigator was carrying three people. Misty Graham had joined Dirk and Al for two reasons. One, whatever project Misty tackled, she threw herself into with every ounce of her soul. After spending every free minute studying the deck plans of the Emerald Dolphin, she knew more about specific compartment locations than anyone on the survey ship. And two, this was an opportunity for her to study the marine organisms of the deep. Once Pitt had loaded the cameras and checked them out, he monitored the life support system before positioning a small reclining seat for his lanky frame. He settled in for the long trip to the seabed by working a crossword puzzle. Occasionally, he looked up and peered out one of the viewports as the light from the surface above began to lose reds, greens, and yellows before turning a dark blue and finally pitch black. Beyond 2,000 feet, they encountered the world of bizarre sea life known as siphonophores, gelatinous predators that come in all shapes and sizes, some less than an inch, others that stretch to more than 120 feet. Misty was in her element as she stared entranced at the remarkably beautiful deep-water siphonophore. Like their jellyfish cousins that inhabited surface waters, they were delicately transparent and came in spectacularly luminescent colors with different characteristic light displays. Pitt was so absorbed by the drama outside his viewport that he never went back to his crossword puzzle. He turned from the port only when Giardino nudged him. "Bottom coming up,"